I'm speaking today with George Graydon. George joined the British Merchant Marine in the 1930s and then served on a variety of ships, a number of ships, throughout World War II. And it's a great privilege for me to be able to talk to you today, George, and get some of your experience on record. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are very interested. Maybe you can start by just telling us a little bit about your early life and how you got into the merchant service in the first place.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. In the early stages of my memory, of course, is not what it used to be, but I'll do the best I can. In the early stages of my life, things were tough because of the fact that we were in the latter stages of a very severe depression around the 1920s, 29, and things were kind of gruff. It was very hard to get a job, and my father had a great deal of difficulty doing so. I had a number of odd jobs while I was still at school. I used to do them in the early morning before going to school. Things were pretty tough because I couldn't afford the normal niceties, if you want to call them that. I used to run around with holes in my boots and holes in the elbows. Food was rather basic when you could get it. And life was kind of grim. Anyway, around the time I was 11, my mother suffered from a lot of delusional problems. She was a peculiar lady. She was very, very brilliant, but she was also, what shall I say, lazy. She read a great deal, didn't like to do housework. She yanked me out of school to do that and ruined my concentration completely. By the time I was about 12 or 13, my brain had locked up. I couldn't remember anything for the next or last half hour. Quite a problem. Anyway, I finally got a few jobs, and then they didn't pay very much, naturally, in those days. And then I got into Bruce Peebles, which was an engine armature, electric engine armature manufacturing section. The lady there was an old Scottish woman, very dour and very hard to reach, hard to read, and hard to understand. Anyway, she didn't like me, which seemed to be natural in those days. And we were forced, there was two boys, another one besides myself. We were supposed to slap 6-foot-long strips of copper, which actually formed part of the armature, in an electric motor to straighten them out on a steel bench. Well, I wasn't physically capable of doing that, but somehow or other I managed it and suffered accordingly. After a couple of months, I kept asking to be transferred to the engineering shop to build engines. I was always mechanically inclined. They refused and told me to get on with the job. Anyway, we finally got fed up with this lady chasing us around, and we being devilish young boys. We schemed up this thing where we could go to the ovens and pick up some of the used shellac, which had been used to insulate or isolate the electrical motor. And we put that in a workman lady's shoes, and of course, she being the dour old Scottish woman, didn't let on until nightfall, and they had to cut the shoes off her. That became a problem. They called us into the office next morning and told us we'd be given to the police. Police came and they called my father and he dealt with it, but I'm not quite sure. Anyway, I ended up getting a scolding at home because I'd been screwed up bringing home money to help the household. And my father, after a couple of days or 3 or 4 days, had a job as a chauffeur to the general manager of the General Steamship Company. And he found out they needed a deck boy on one of the ships, so he yanked me down there and he said, "That's it, you're on your own." So I went down there and went aboard ship, and of course, life, I thought I'd changed and got away from that hell at home. Ended up in just as bad a situation.
I remember reading your memoir, and one of the harrowing situations that I recall is you having to change a mast light bulb in a raging storm, and I just couldn't imagine what that was like. Maybe you could just talk about that and maybe how hard that life was, because I don't think people today really understand that.
No, it's, you know, in my course of travels, of course, I traveled the world, and we ended up in the Far East and ended up in New Zealand at one time, and I was shocked at the difference in the way the treatment of the seamen were in comparison with the UK. The UK, when you need all about the Navy and in the ancient days of being kind of stripped off the streets and shoved in a boat and or a ship, and that was it. They went round in gangs and picked people up. That was the kind of thing that prevailed right up until, oh, I would think after the war. Some of our old antics in the maritime situation carried on from the old peacetime days. They were not good. Conditions were definitely not good. Once we went deep sea, it was a little better because on the coast, nothing was provided by the ship owners. You bought your own food, you cooked your own food, and you bought your own clothes, everything. Even bed clothes, you had to provide them. There was mattresses, but they weren't very thick, most uncomfortable. And normally, in the old British ships, all the accommodation for both the firemen was with a coal-fired ship or even an oil-fired ship. The deck crew and the black crew, as they call them, in the stokehold, all shared the same accommodation. It was up in the bow of the ship. And, man, that's where you smashed into the sea. It took water over the bow. And the North Sea is being famous for, as long as I remember, for poor weather. We get gale after gale, and we get cold, wet, wind, snow, fog, you name it. And, of course, if you get down towards the coast on the east side of England, you get sandbanks which are created and changed rapidly by the currents there. The rise and fall of tide is quite severe, and it does affect it. But life in those days, because you couldn't get work, was grim, because it didn't matter what you did or what people did to you, you hung on to that job and you kept your mouth shut. If you didn't, you got fired on the spot because there were so many people waiting to take the job. Now, it was a problem there also because of the fact that during the Depression, a lot of the officers and the better crewmen went ashore and left the sea, because the sea is not, it's a very, very harsh business. You either like it or you don't, and even when you don't, you're sometimes forced to stay with it because of conditions, economic conditions primarily. But basically, a seaman's life is pretty grim, because you on a coaster, you work 7 days a week, and you're 4 hours on and 4 hours off. And let me tell you, that is pretty grim in the wintertime particularly.
Yeah, I can't imagine what, you know, a four-hour shift and then 4 hours sleep and then back to work again would be like.
Let me correct you. It's not 4 hours sleep, because you come off watch soaking wet, frozen, cold, miserable, and you go in, you have to go then and you either take clothes off or whatever. You go into the galley, you make a meal because you need to eat. And there you need to eat fairly well because the cold saps your energy. And then by the time you cook something and eaten it and then stripped off, you dive into your bunk. You got to be up again at least an hour or three quarters of an hour before you go on watch again. So you'll get 2 hours sleep maximum.
Wow.
And in the meantime, there are people doing stuff just right alongside you. They're either reading, they're snoring, or they're clashing teeth, or they're doing something or other, and you're trying to sleep. In the meantime, the ship is bashing into a head sea or whatever, and there's water pouring around the deck. So the whole thing is quite miserable.
Well, it's worse than I thought, actually.
It's very difficult to describe. I'm going again on memory, and I did eventually go to the Nautical College in Glasgow and sat for my officer navigation certificate, which I passed, fortunately. And life was quite different after that. But let me tell you, in the forecastle, as we call it, that's a forecastle. In other words, the bow of the accommodation. Life was grim. On the Arctic convoys, it was even worse because with the condensation and the low temperatures, we had a foot of ice inside. And don't forget, the steel is bare. It's painted, but it's bare. So there is definitely no insulation of any kind to help to avoid that or mitigate it.
So by the time war started, you had quite a few years of experience.
Oh, yes. I actually first went to sea as a deck boy in June 1936. The exact date I have here somewhere, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, definitely June 1936. And I was I was pretty young then, about 14, 15, with very, very little education. Actually, very, very minimal. I told you I quit school at 11. My mother used to write all kinds of false notes to say she was ill and that she needed me at home. And when I went home, I cleaned the floors, washed the dishes, and cleaned kids up, took them out, and brought them back, and all the rest of it. Life was miserable, as you can imagine.
I think it's an amazing achievement that you managed to go from deckhand to bridge officer in not that many years.
True, but the point is, I had a burning obsession to learn. I had a dreadful habit of asking why, and for some reason or other, even my mother started that. She used to whack me over the head because I kept asking questions, but I wanted to learn. Why did it work? How did it work? What makes it go? It was just in me, and that was it. And somehow, on one or two of the watches, officers never spoke to the crew, except to give orders. But I was fortunate in a couple of instances, particularly with second mates. I said to them, "Sir, can I ask you a question?" And he would say, "No," or "Yes." And I would say, "Can you tell me what that thing is there for? What does it do? And why is it there?" And when I asked about stars, they got really interested. Here's some idiot from the crew wants to know about stars. And he was bored to tears, so he took it under consideration. And then we started with the navigation. And while I was on the wheel, usually for 2 hours, he would explain anything to me. And usually that was on the midnight till 4 a.m. watch, which is what we call the kind of dead man's watch type of thing. There's nothing happening, and it's the lowest dead of life around 2:30 a.m., as you probably know.
During the war, you served on a number of different ships and a range of different kinds of convoys. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, let me tell you about the East Coast first. That was a frightening experience during the early parts of the war. I was in one or two coasters there that were... We were actually reporting to a pool during the war. They established they'd move men and officers as required to different ships as they needed them. Either the men left and changed, or each voyage, not the coaster you signed on for 6 months, but each voyage on the deep sea, so-called, was an individual contract, and it quit when you came back. So you either left the ship and reported to the shipping pool of men and officers, and they allocated you to any one ship that was available wherever. You'd either go from Leith, which was where I was based, or they give you a train ticket to go to Cardiff, Liverpool, Glasgow, or whatever. to join whatever ship they allocated you to. So this was the reason I was in so many different ships, in so many different places. And primarily, I was in most theaters of war. I have the so-called medals to prove it. And I've also got voyage cards from most of the ships. I also have references from every ship I've been on, Captain. The East Coast convoys were particularly bad because, one, weather. Two, we had very narrow channels between the sandbanks. Convoys were in two columns up and down the coast. We had constant bombing. We had primarily Stukas, and they carried a stick of five bombs. They also were fitted with a very, very high-pitched siren. It was, when we first heard it, it's nerve-shattering. And, of course, they dropped the bombs, and unless you're pretty accurate with a four-inch gun, they're in before you get a chance to do anything. Once they provided us with the heavier Bofors and the Oerlikon, twin Oerlikon cannons, we were much better off. But we used to go down in convoy, and often both the Germans and the British mined the outside the channels. The Germans put the mines in the middle of the channel, or the weather broke the mines away and they were floating on the surface, and you'd hit them if you were unlucky. When a mine hits a ship, it usually breaks its back because they're small coasters. Not only that, we had on dark nights, we had E-boats, German E-boats, which were fairly high-powered, triple-engined, what they call motor torpedo boats. They didn't have torpedoes, but they ran down. They had multiple machine guns. They ran down between the two columns at 40 knots, throwing hand grenades on the deck. Now, nobody went to sleep, naturally. We all used to sleep on deck. Cold, wet, didn't matter. We, you know, we knew we were dead men. We accepted that fact. But we figured, the hell with it, we'll take somebody with us. And we were all pretty grim. We were, by that time, we were pretty brutal animals. And what happened when the E-boats went down the middle of the channel? Of course, everybody's firing. So you had problems with ricochets. And you could see the tracer bullets, which is about every seventh one. You saw the angle of them, and then you saw the tracers from the other ships coming your way. So between that and the E-boats running down the channel, throwing depth charges, or not, hand grenades aboard, it was quite something. And then, of course, you could get that in combination with bombs, which were the Stuka dive bombers. They were particularly bad, as I say, because they were very efficient. The when the mines actually, when we got the convoy escort, the senior officer would advise us that mines were adrift, and then of course you're quaking in your shoes. Naturally, you're looking for the mines. You're trying to watch the ship ahead. You're trying to watch where the ship's going. You're trying to steer, and if somebody gets hit, well, God help you, because you got to do everything you can if you're on the helm to avoid running through the men who were in the water, hit the wrecked ship and wreck yourself, or pull over clear and hit the ship next to you with the convoy. It was a total nightmare, especially at dark or in fog. So you can imagine what it was like on the East Coast. This was day and night. I mean, there was no respite at all. And of course, when we went on to London, we tied up at St. Catherine's Wharf, which is, if you know London at all, the bow used to be right up tight to the Tower Bridge. That meant that we were in the middle of the bombing raids whenever they took place, and that was a very, very disastrous situation. I had one case where we were going up the river, and the pilot was calling, when you run the river, you've got heavy tides, heavy, when you get wind and tide and current together, you've got a tremendous amount of water pouring down there at high speed. And of course, with the twists and turns, they can push you over towards the side of the river if you're not careful. You have to be extremely concentrated on the helm. Now, you do that in the middle of a bombing raid, Yeah, I mean, we were talking about 600 bombers at a time. And you've got the anti-aircraft fire going up, the bombs coming down. And then at one time, we had the Tate & Lyle sugar factory blown up. And the sugar was alight on the surface of the river along with the Shell oil refinery. So between that and trying to clear sunken barges and all the rest of it, and all the garbage on the river and through the flames, it was a nightmare when you were steering and you could only see through slots in the armor in the front of the wheelhouse. And the pilot would be there in the clear, given orders to change the helm port, starboard, and the speed, you know, a bit, few more revs up or down. It became a nightmare. And you get a tremendous claustrophobic effect when you're in an enclosed wheelhouse and not able to assess the situation, bad as it is. You can well imagine all that going on, going up the Rendon River, which is a very tricky place to maneuver.
One of the things that I got from your memoir, and I think most people don't realize today, is that when a ship was wrecked, the sailors' pay stopped at that point.
Right, at noon on the day.
That's really unbelievable.
Well, it was this. It one of the things, and again, don't take me for ranting or raving. I'm giving facts, I always do. I have, all my life, never wasted time in regrets. What happened then, and we were very, when we found out, actually I was in the Harpalium, and the Stinger bombs slid underneath the stern of the ship. She was about 5,000 or 6,000 gross dead weight, and freighter, and we carried freight up to Russia, and on the way back, we were hit with a Stinger bombs, and it blew the rudder off, and part of the shaft was bent. We had to, actually, we thought that we might be able to rig a raft on each side and paddle, you know, move them up and down to steer the ship. And the escort commander said, hell no, we can't mess about. Abandon ship, we'll put an extra couple of rounds in her and get her sunk before the Germans can come out with tugs and save her and use them against us. So that's what happened. And then, from then on, I mean, it's very hard to describe this because we were abandoning ship. And now you've got to remember we were on the lee side of the ship, an empty ship, which was high out in the water. And we had a 25-30 knot gale blowing down. So the ship was drifting like a sail on top of the lifeboat. Now the boats, the weather's bad, so the boat was jumping up and down, scraping on the side while we were trying to get men into her. And, of course, the rope falls were very difficult to unhook. And if you unhook one and the wave comes the wrong way, it'll tip the boat and out you go. And you will last about 2 minutes in that water. On top of that, we had to get the boat turned so that the bow was downwind and then shove off and paddle like hell and pull on the oars to get clear of her and let her drift past us. In the meantime, the Fury was standing by us, giving us a hand, because something like 6 or 7 bombers were coming in on the ship, and they were machine gunning the boats at the same time as they were dropping bombs alongside us and on the ship.
So the Germans were actually trying to kill the seamen.
Oh, yeah. We found out afterwards that Hitler had issued orders, kill the crews as much as you can, because, not from an inhuman point of view, which it was, but because they knew as well as us that we could buy new and build new ships. We could buy them from the States and every other non-country, you know, non-wartime country, but you couldn't trace men to handle them. So, and they also knew that we had a very small pool of efficient men left because of the poor conditions during the 29 recession, and it made life hell. And then, of course, finally the Fury came back and picked us up. And I don't know if you've ever been in a warship at all, but a warship doing 29 knots around the convoy because some of the ships were lost, right? And she was doing extra duty and racing around at 21 knots in bad weather. We were laying on the deck in the forepeak, and which was the place where the sailors hung their hammocks. But they had no extra room for us, and there were 70 of us. And we were laying on there, and there was water running around, 3 or 4 inches of filthy water and everything. We didn't care. We were dead. I mean, we hadn't had any sleep for about 3 months. We had cat naps, but we never undressed, so we stank like pigs. And our clothes were really in tatters, you know. And we had boils, you know, where the rough cloth was rubbing on the skin where the salt water was. It was grim. And then the Commodore asked if we wanted to transfer to the cruiser. We said, no, hell, we'll stay here. So we ended up in Reykjavik, and we were transferred to an American troop ship called the Borin Queen. She had, I think, 5,000 American and 1,000 British ships on, troops, and they were going to Liverpool. Anyway, we get aboard, and of course, everybody scattered because we were filthy. I mean, there's no arguments, we were filthy. We hadn't shaved, we didn't dare shave, we didn't do anything. Because if you get caught with your pants down and the ship blown up, you're dead. You know, with no clothes, no nothing, no chance. Anyway, we went to sleep, and at 5 in the morning, some idiot blew reveille on the bugle. And, of course, 70 pairs of boots ended up in his direction. We were all mad as hell. And the MPs came, and there was a goddamn uproar, a bloody mess, let me tell you. Because we were wild. I mean, we were absolutely just gone beyond sense. We didn't give a damn about anything except we wanted to sleep. Anyway, the SEAL came and we said to him, look, we don't want any of your crap. We're survivors. We've been through shit and hell. We don't want this. We need sleep. Well, when the SEAL heard this, and our captain was there to explain, he said, okay, no more bugle. And the troops actually went absolutely, I don't know, I've never seen anything like it. They went berserk. They didn't realize who we were. They thought we were just a bunch of crap. And when they realized we'd come off the convoy, but being playing poker from New York, and there was a big sheet on the table, they pulled it together and they said, here, boys, share the dough. I got $72. And in those days, that was a fortune. And, you know, between them all, between the soldiers and the ship's crew, they gave us all new clothes, all clean clothes, top to bottom, including shoes, for God's sake. And we get into Liverpool, and then we got a coupon to get our train home to Leith. Went down to the pool office, and I'm telling you, that was a shock. Walked in and said, okay, wages. And when he gave us a check, I said, what the hell is this? Well, he said, your wages finished at noon on the day of the ship sank. And a very sarcastic manner, I must admit. Well, I had him by the hair before he'd finished, was banging him on the counter. And they called the police. You know what they did? They said, okay, sir, you've got a choice. Back to sea within 24 hours or we'll take it to court.
And, of course, all your gear had gone down with
everything,
the ship.
Everything, all my navigation books, all my clothes. I'd lost 3 beautiful cowhide suitcases I'd bargained for in the bazaar in Singapore. Everything, clothes, you name it. And it was, you know, it was serious. What a terrible thing that was, and it left a filthy taste. And once I started to check, I found out that the government had covered any ship that got us, that was blown up or damaged or whatever, as long as she could make the convoy assembly point, she was covered by government insurance. Well, that didn't taste very good. It didn't taste very good at all. So it kind of left a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
I'd like to move on, if you don't mind, a particular ship that I have a connection to as well, as you know, and that's the Zamalek, the rescue ship.
Oh, yeah.
And you spent quite a long time on that ship, and it has such a celebrated history. I'd love to hear your experiences about serving on her.
Well, let me tell you, I had a very poor entry to her. I must be honest. Captain Morris, he's probably the best navigator and the best ship handler I ever actually worked with. He was superb, and he taught me a great deal, I must admit. When we first met, he said, could you imagine Glasgow in the summer, warm? It doesn't happen except on a Wednesday afternoon. But anyway, I had gone to my cabin, found it, gone to the cabin. First of all, I was shocked when I saw what looked like a ship I was on. I didn't even know what I was on. And she was so well-armed, and she was battered, rusty, and the welders were working, and, you know, it was just, I thought, what the hell am I doing here? Anyway, I get down to my cabin. I was taken on as, I was offered the job as third officer. So, okay, went down there, changed, and then it was too warm, so I had a shirt on, uniform shirt, tie, and epaulets. I thought I was okay. Went into the war room and started talking. And a rough voice said, "Who are you?" When I identified and said, "Well, get back to your cabin and dress properly." That was my introduction to Captain Morris.
So he was a stickler for those
things.
Oh,
he was a stickler, but he was, I learned afterwards. Of course, one of my problems were, I'd become very, we knew we were dead men. We accepted that fact. And it made us very, I can't describe it. We weren't brutal, but we were callous.
Just not ready to put up with stuff.
Well, there was no way, and especially me, I had come through a bad early childhood. And anybody even looked at me the wrong way, I used to spat for them, you know, go for them. And it was my own fault. I didn't have enough sense to qualify a conversation properly, you know. And I just looked at him and I went, "Ugh." Never said a word, went back, dressed, came back again and looked at his face. And him and I, we were never friends, okay? But I'll tell you, he's got my utmost respect. He's a fabulous navigator, ship handler, and a man, and a top-notch captain.
Maybe you could just describe what the rescue ships were and how they functioned in convoys.
Okay, well, do you want me to talk about the rescue ship or about the convoys?
About the Zamalek and how it was. I mean,
right.
It was a fairly small ship.
She was a coaster. Let's face it, there's no arguments there. And that was vital in order to have low freeboard. Every ship that was considered had to have low freeboard so we could get nets over the side, and in some cases get a ladder or somebody would get down and help people aboard, any way to get men aboard, okay? Because we were never properly fitted. I mean, they grabbed these ships and shoved them out quickly. And the other thing I remember is there was an article where the DMT, Department of Transport, did not want to let these ships go. They needed the ships. They said, "To hell with it. We'll, you know." But the government, fortunately, overrode them because we picked up, I think the total is pretty close under 2,000 men in total. There was 25 rescue ships altogether. The enemy part of the war was absolute hell because there was nothing to stop the submarines. We didn't have enough escorts, destroyer-type escorts, to chase the subs. And they had a ball. And that was went on for about probably 2.5 years, until late 42, early 43. But what the rescue ship did, she was the ocean convoys, let me say that, probably, say, 40, 50 in the convoy. And they would be spread over about 10 miles because what you did, you had columns. There were probably five columns, and each one was at least 100 yards apart, had to spread out like that, because merchant ships are very difficult to keep on a straight line. You need a top-notch helmsman, and you get weather, you get all kinds of conditions. You get poor engines, you get engines failing, all kinds of things. But in the meantime, you endeavor to keep station. Now, in fog, you trail, you have a blue light on the stern, which the guy in the ship behind you follows. Now, in fog, it's very difficult to discern whether you're close or far away or whatever. And a ship, a merchant ship, is ponderous. She's normally, for economic reasons, underpowered. She's laboring because she's loaded. That's what she's built for, to carry as much cargo as she can possibly do with the minimum expense. Now, that's been going on from time immemorial. Naval ships, on the other hand, are built narrow for speed, maneuverability, and can turn on a dime. And we had a lot of trouble between merchantmen and Royal Navy men to get this concept across to the Navy guys. They thought we were idiots because we couldn't maneuver our ships like theirs. We had to tell them and teach them that that can't be done with a merchant ship. Anyway, it created a lot of problems, but the rescue ship took the position at the stern of the convoy in the middle and used to act as a shepherd. Anybody lagging behind, go over and say, hey, get a move on, get back in line. What are you doing? If a big air raid came along, we'd storm up to the middle because we were very heavily armed. And we had 22 gunners, actually, naval gunners aboard, and racks of 20 millimeter Oricon guns. We had a Bofors, and we had a 4-inch gun aft. So we were fairly well armed. We had to be. When the rescue ship went to help a ship sunk or whatever, the convoy never stopped. It wasn't allowed to carry on. And the rescue ship would often be on her own for quite a while, picking up survivors or whatever, and then have to race like hell, go back, and they never had enough escorts to leave an escort with the rescue ship to protect her. So, and until near the end of the war, when the Americans helped and they built fast escort ships, that's when the submarine thing was dealt with. You know, the menace from the submarines.
We probably should explain to people that the Zemalek served in various places, the Atlantic, off West Africa, but your experience was in the Arctic convoys to Murmansk and Archangel, correct?
Oh, yes, but also to Halifax in the ocean Atlantic convoys.
Okay,
and
I see.
That we were in Halifax quite a number of times, we were in Iceland a number of times, and we were in Murmansk. Okay, so you can tell. I was not on her at PQ-17, fortunately. And also, I did not do the African trip now. But I was on one of the biggest convoys, and I don't quote me now, but I was somewhere around 140 ships coming from Halifax. And the surgeon was the general practitioner doctor for nearly 12,000 men. So you can imagine, even though the weather's poor, we got to get that rescue boat over and either take the surgeon there or bring invalid back to the rescue ship.
I imagine transferring between ships and convoys wasn't easy.
See, yeah, that's right. We did a lot of that, yeah. And Duncan McDermott was the second officer, but he was a very good friend of mine, actually. He was designated as rescue officer. And then what they did, primarily I was on the bridge with the captain. And we had a chief officer and a first officer. And I believe, now, don't quote me on this, but I believe that one went to the, in the case of Ashim, in case we were blown up, because the torpedo was always heading for the engine room and the bridge. If we were blown up, then either one of these two survived, they could take over the ship. So that was what the rig was. And then the rescue boats, with the second mate would take off with the first one, then the bosun. Then if they needed more, I would take it. So that's the way we worked.
Yeah, I should explain.
Duncan was very good. Sorry.
I should explain my connection to the Zamalek is that my father was third engineer for a couple of years during the war.
Right, yeah. Well, I unfortunately didn't meet him. I knew Duncan McDermott, I knew Mr. McNaughton, and I knew, of course, knew Captain Morris, and Ron Fisher. I've got to tell you, Ron Fisher, the surgeon, he was magnificent. To watch him operate under storm conditions was a delight to watch him. That sounds stupid, but you know what I mean when I say I believe in doing a job properly. And so did he. And he did it under the most adverse conditions.
So
he tried desperately to be in a position where he'd earn a medal, and I don't think he ever did, which I think was dreadful.
So what were you doing when the war ended?
Well, I still was at sea, and what happened then, actually, I was starting to get a little disgusted because British seamen, and I don't, officers are similar, they, you're at the mercy of the ship owner. Now, some companies are well worthwhile. They will treat you reasonably. Most of them didn't, or they didn't care. And I was employed about a 15,000-ton ship. She came in, and she had Alaska crew, and they sent me down as second officer on the ship. Now, we had to take her, not out ocean-going, but we had to take her around the coast for repairs, I believe, to Liverpool. Anyway, I did everything I could, and I kept waiting for the chief officer, but in the meantime, I did all his work. And that, my friend, entails water, fuel, everything connected, all the provisions, everything, and prepare for dry docking. And when we started to get ready to go underway, I said to the captain, "Where's the chief officer?" He said, "Well, you'll have to do it." I said, "Well, where's the designation? I mean, I should have been signed on as chief officer. I'm certificated." He said, "Well, no, we can't do that." I said, "Okay, I'll deal with it." So when we got to Liverpool and I got signed off, I called the union and I said, "Listen, this is dreadful. What the devil's going on?" So they said, "Okay, we understand. We'll take up your case." So I won, and they sent me a check. It was poor, but what the devil. And I said, "That's it. I've had my share of this life of the sea." And a friend of mine that...
it fair to say that subsequent to the war, it's taken a long time for merchant seamen to really get the recognition they deserve for their contribution?
Let me tell you, I don't think they ever will in the UK. I find here it's much more prevalent here than it is in the UK. You have a social barrier, as you know, well know. There are about five layers of the social barrier in the UK. They're slowly being destroyed, but God Almighty, they're still there. And seamen looked on as the scruff of the earth. And let me tell you, the Admiralty and the Lords of the Admiralty are about as low in every seaman, including the writer, myself, about as low as we can get. They used to talk down all the time about the troubles and the horrors and the dangers of what we were doing. And Sir Dudley Pound was the epitome. He condemned men to death stupidly. And this is supposed to be the top-notch admiral. So we have, I speak, I'm sure, for most seamen and officers, we don't think much of them. And because of the Navy, they built this resentment and addition where they thought all captains were the dropouts of the colleges and the seamen were the scum of the earth. That didn't go down very well, and it still stays with both the populace and ourselves today. My brother, who was a maroon dog, actually blown up with a sabotage coming out of Cape Town, And they rowed about 100 miles. The ship went down. They rowed about 100 miles. And he was escorted by natives for almost 300 miles, I understand. This is secondhand, to civilization. And he got home, and walking down the street, some bloody dame put a white feather in his pocket. That's the type of thing that we put up with.
We should explain for people who are living currently that merchant seamen were considered civilians, even though they were definitely in harm's way. And I've heard that their losses proportionately were second only to the Marines in terms of the loss of life.
Correct. Correct. Their proportionate losses were as high as any of the services, and I believe in excess of most. And let me explain. One of the major things about this, Churchill praised the RAF. Now, I have no arguments for that at all. But the RAF, the Marines, the Americans, everybody, nobody would have done anything without the merchant marine. Everything that moved was moved with merchant marine shipping. And, I mean, that's what makes it so bad, you know.
Well, I hope that this has redressed some of that misunderstanding. And it's been great to hear you talk about your experiences, George. A real privilege for me. And I really appreciate it. I want to thank you very much. And also on behalf of people who listen to this.
It's a pleasure, actually, to talk with you, primarily because very few people are aware. And even today, I mean, a seaman, I've had that thing. I took a lady out in London. I had this girl. She was a waitress in the coffee shop. And I went down to meet her father, and he said, "God almighty, you're only a damn seaman. You're not even an officer." And I said, "Sir, what are you?" He said, "I'm a baker." "Thank you. Good day." I mean, this is truth. It's what we dealt with.
Well,
you cannot really. It's very, no, it's very hard to describe without being carried away, you know, the feeling. Let me tell you this. My belief, and every damn seaman and officer I'm aware of knows, that we would be under German yoke today if it wasn't for the merchant seamen.
I absolutely agree with that, and that's as good a point to end as any. I thank you so much, George.